whole families at a time, to their deaths. The surf ran red with their blood. So many broken bodies floated in the water that Navy craft overrode them to rescue. Not all the dead had volunteered their sacrifice. Many had been rallied, pushed, or shot by Japanese soldiers. The mass suicide on Saipan, a Jonestown of its day, instructed Americans further in the nature of the Jap. Not only soldiers, but also civilians, ordinary men and women and children, chose death before surrender. On their home islands, the Japanese were 100 million strong, and they would take a lot of killing. The view was stupendous, and the wind was bitter cold, Leona Marshall recalls of a day at Hanford, Washington, in September 1944, when she, Enrico Fermi, and Crawford Greenwalt climbed giddily to the top of a 12-story tower to survey the secret reservation. They could see the Columbia River running deep and blue in both directions out of sight over the horizon. They could see the gray desert and the distant hazy mountains. By then, construction was more than two-thirds completed, and nearer at hand, they overlooked a city of industrial buildings and barracks and three massive blockhouses, the three plutonium production reactors sited on the river's western shore. The number of construction workers had peaked at 42,400 the previous June. Marshall was working now at Hanford. Fermi and Greenwalt had traveled out to monitor the startup of the B pile, the first one finished. The day the construction teams left it, September 13th, Fermi had inserted the first aluminum-canned uranium slug to begin the loading, the Pope conferring his blessing as he had on the piles at Chicago and Oak Ridge. Slug canning had almost come to a crisis. 2 years of trial-and-error effort had not produced canning technology adequate to seal the uranium slugs, which quickly oxidized upon exposure to air or water, away from corrosion. Only in August had the crucial step been devised by a young research chemist who had followed the problem from DuPont in Wilmington to Chicago and then to Hanford. Putting aside elaborate dips and baths, he tried soaking the bear slugs in molten solder, lowering the aluminum cans into the solder with tongs, and canning the slugs submerged. The melting point of the aluminum was not much higher than the melting point of the solder, but with careful temperature control, the canning technique worked. Greenwalt then pushed production around the clock. Slugs accumulated in the reactor building faster than the loading crews could use them, and Marshall and Fermi observed them there on one of their inspections. Enrico and I went to the reactor building to watch the loading. The slugs were brought to the floor in solid wooden blocks in which holes were drilled, each of a size to contain a slug, and the wooden blocks were stacked much as had been the slug-containing graphite bricks in CP1. Idly, I teased Fermi, saying it looked like a chain-reacting pile. Fermi turned white, gasped, and reached for his slide rule. But after a couple of seconds, he relaxed, realizing that under no circumstances could natural uranium and natural wood in any configuration cause a chain reaction. Tuesday evening, September 26th, 1944, the largest atomic pile yet assembled on Earth was ready. It had reached dry criticality, the smaller loading at which it would have gone critical without cooling water if its operators had not restrained it with control rods the previous Friday. Now the Columbia circulated through its 1,500 loaded aluminum tubes. "We arrived in the control room as the DuPont brass began to assemble," Marshall remembers. "The operators were all in place, well rehearsed, with their startup manuals on their desks. Some of the observers had celebrated with good whiskey. Their exhalations braced the air. Marshall and Fermi strolled the room, checking readings. The operators withdrew the control rods in stages, just as Fermi had once directed for CP1. Once again, he calculated the neutron flux on his 6-inch slide rule. Gradually, gauges showed the cooling water warmed, flowing in at 50 degrees Fahrenheit and out at 140. And there it was. The first plutonium production reactor operating smoothly and steadily and quietly. Even in the control room, one could hear the steady roaring sound, of the high-pressure water rushing through the cooling tubes. The pile went critical a few minutes past midnight. By 2 a.m., it was operating at a higher level of power than any previous chain reaction. For the space of an hour, all was well. Then Marshall remembers the operating engineers whispering to each other, adjusting control rods, whispering more urgently. Something was wrong. The pile reactivity was steadily decreasing with time. The control rods had to be withdrawn continuously from the pile to hold it at 100 megawatts. The time came when the rods were completely withdrawn. The reactor power began to drop, down and down. Early Wednesday evening, B pile died. Marshall and Fermi had slept by then and returned. They talked over the mystery with the engineers, who first suspected a leaking tube or boron in the river water somehow plating out on the cladding. Fermi chose to remain open-minded. The charts, which seemed to show a straight-line failure, might be hiding the shallow curve of an exponential decline in reactivity, which would mean a fission product undetected in previous piles was poisoning the reaction. Early Thursday morning, the pile came back to life. By 7 a.m., it was running well above critical again. But 12 hours later, it began another decline. Princeton theoretician John A. Wheeler had counseled Crawford Greenwalt on pile physics since DuPont first joined the project. He was stationed at Hanford now, and he followed the second failure of the pile closely. He had been concerned for months, he writes, about fission product poisons. B pile's heavy breathing convinced him such a poisoning had occurred. The mechanism would be compound. A non-neutron-absorbing mother fission product of some hour's half-life decays to a daughter dangerous to neutrons. This poison itself decays with a half-life of some hours into a third nuclear species, non-absorbing and possibly even stable. So the pile would chain react, making the mother product. The mother product would decay to the daughter. As the volume of daughter product increased, absorbing neutrons, the pile would decline. When sufficient daughter product was present, enough neutrons would be absorbed to starve the chain reaction and the pile would shut down. Then, the daughter product would decay to a non-absorbing third element. As it decayed, the pile would stir. Eventually, too little daughter product would remain to inhibit the chain reaction and the pile would go critical again. Fermi had left for the night. Wheeler, on watch, calculated the likely half-lives based on the blooming and fading of the pile. By morning, he thought he needed two radioactivities with half-lives totaling about 15 hours. If this explanation made sense, then an inspection of the chart of nuclei showed that the mother had to be 6.68 HR, iodine, 135, and the daughter 9.13 HR, xenon, 135. Within an hour, Fermi arrived with detailed reactivity data which checked this assignment. Within 3 hours, two additional conclusions were clear. A, the cross-section for absorption of thermal neutrons by Xe-135 was roughly 150 times that of the most absorptive nucleus previously known, cadmium-113. B, almost every Xe-135 nucleus formed in a high-flux reactor would take a neutron out of circulation. Xenon had thrust itself in as an unexpected and unwanted extra control rod. To override this poison, more reactivity was needed. Greenwalt called Samuel Allison in Chicago on Friday afternoon. Allison passed the bad news to Walter Zinn at Argonne, the laboratory in the forest south of Chicago where CP1 was meant to be housed, and where several piles now operated. Zinn had just shut down CP3, a shielded 6-foot tank filled with 6.5 tons of heavy water in which 121 aluminum-clad uranium rods were suspended. Disbelieving, Zinn started the 300-kilowatt reactor up again and ran it at full power for 12 hours. It was primarily a research instrument, and it had never been run so long at full power before. He found the xenon effect. Laborious calculations at Hanford over the next 3 days confirmed it. Groves received the news acidly. He had ordered Compton to run CP3 at full power full time to look for just such trouble. Ever the optimist, Compton apologized in the name of pure science. The mistake was regrettable, but it had led to a fundamentally new discovery regarding neutron properties of matter. He meant xenon's consuming appetite for neutrons. Groves would have preferred to blaze trails less flamboyantly. If DuPont had built the Hanford production reactors to Eugene Wigner's original specifications, which were elegantly economical, all three piles would have required complete rebuilding now. Fortunately, Wheeler had fretted about fission product poisoning. After the massive wooden shield blocks that formed the front and rear faces of the piles had been pressed a year previously, he had advised the chemical company to increase the count of uranium channels for a margin of safety. Wigner's 1,500 channels were arranged cylindrically. The corners of the cubical graphite sacks could accommodate another 504. That necessitated drilling out the shield blocks, which delayed construction and added millions to the cost. DuPont had accepted the delay and drilled the extra channels. They were in place now, when they were needed, although not yet connected to the water supply. D-pile went critical with a full 2,000 four-tube loading on December 17, 1944. B-pile followed on December 28th. Plutonium production in quantity had finally begun. Groves was enthusiastic enough at year's end to report to George Marshall that he expected to have 18 5-kilogram plutonium bombs on hand in the second half of 1945. "Looks like a race," Conant noted for his history file on January 6, 1945. "To see whether a fat man or a thin man will be dropped first, and whether the month will be July, August, or September." 17. The Evils of This Time. The bombs James Brian Conant speculated about early in 1945 were crude designs of uncertain yield. The previous October, he had traveled out to Los Alamos to ascertain their prospects. To Vannevar Bush, he reported that the gun method of detonation seemed as nearly certain as any untried new procedure can be. The availability of a uranium gun bomb, which Los Alamos expected would explode with a force equivalent to about 10,000 tons of TNT, now depended only on the separation of sufficient U-235. Implosion looked far more questionable. Intensive work was just then getting underway, following Oppenheimer's August reorganization of the laboratory. Conant estimated the yield of the first implosion design, whether lensed or not, as an order of magnitude only at about 1,000 tons TNT equivalent. That was so relatively modest a result that he invited Bush to consider the gun bomb strategic and the implosion bomb tactical. For the past 3 years, Bush and Conant had concentrated their efforts entirely on these first crude bombs. Now they were interested in improvements. During the summer of 1944, Conant says, on an earlier inspection trip to Los Alamos, he and Bush had found leisure and privacy to discuss what the policy of the United States should be after the war was over. As a result, they had sent Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson a joint memorandum on September 19th, that independently raised some of the issues Niels Bohr had raised with Franklin Roosevelt in August, in particular that the progress of this art and science is bound to be so rapid in the next 5 years in some countries that it would be extremely dangerous for this government to assume that by holding secret its present knowledge, we should be secure. They did not see the bomb's complementarity, but did see that whatever control arrangement the United States and Great Britain devised, they favored a treaty, would somehow have to include the Soviet Union. If the Soviets were not informed, as Bush told Conant, the exclusion would lead to a very undesirable relationship indeed on the subject with Russia. Roosevelt had returned from Hyde Park troubled that Felix Frankfurter and Bohr had somehow breached Manhattan Project security. Bush and perhaps Conant had talked to Bohr, and the two administrators had submitted to Stimson at his request a more detailed proposal incorporating Bohr's ideas. In doing so, they had explicitly recommended that the United States sacrifice some portion of its national sovereignty in exchange for effective international control, understanding as they did so that they would have to answer vigorous opposition. In order to meet the unique situation created by the development of this new art, we would propose that free interchange of all scientific information on this subject be established under the auspices of an international office deriving its power from whatever association of nations is developed at the close of the present war. We would propose further that as soon as practical, the technical staff of this office be given free access in all countries, not only to the scientific laboratories where such work is contained, but to the military establishments as well. We recognize that there will be great resistance to this measure, but believe the hazards to the future of the world are sufficiently great to warrant this attempt. But how great, in fact, were the hazards? That was something else Conant traveled to Los Alamos in October to find out. If the argument for allowing the nation's military establishments to be inspected depended on the dangers of a thermonuclear explosive, it was speculative and therefore weak. The thermonuclear was still only an idea on paper that might not work. How much could fission weapons be improved? How much destructiveness of either kind might a bomber, or, as Bush and Conant briefed Stimson, a robot plane or guided missile, eventually visit upon the cities of the world? What Conant learned, first of all, was that others had already begun to ask the same questions. The technological imperative, the urge to improvement, even if the objects to be improved are weapons of mass destruction, was already operating at Los Alamos. Under intense pressure to produce a first crude weapon in time to affect the outcome of the war, people had found occasion, nevertheless, to think about building a better bomb. Conant reported to Bush, "By various methods that seem quite possible of development within 6 months after the first bomb is perfected, it should be possible to increase the efficiency, in which case the same amount of material would yield something like 24,000 tons of TNT equivalent. Further developments along this same line hold a possibility of producing a single bomb with such amounts of materials and such efficiencies as to run this figure up to several hundred thousand tons of TNT equivalent, or even perhaps a million tons TNT equivalent. All these possibilities reside only in perfecting the efficiency of the use of elements 25, U-235, and 49, PU-239. You will thus see that a considerable super bomb is in the offing, quite apart from the use of other nuclear reactions." A million tons TNT equivalent was devastation indeed. The world war then raging would consume a total of about 3 million tons of explosives by its end. But Edward Teller, Conant found, had already dismissed such improvements as picayune. It seems that the possibility of inciting a thermonuclear reaction involving heavy hydrogen is somewhat less now than appeared at first sight 2 years ago. I heard an hour's talk on this subject by the leading theoretical man at L.A. The most hopeful procedure is to use tritium, the radioactive isotope of hydrogen made in a pile, as a sort of booster in the reaction, the fission bomb being used as the detonator, and the reaction involving the atoms of liquid deuterium being prime explosive. Such a gadget should produce an explosive equivalent to 100 million tons of TNT, which in turn should produce Class B damage over an area of 3,000 square miles. This last real superbomb is probably at least as distant now as was the fission bomb when you and I first heard of the Enterprise. The thermonuclear was something of a Rorschach test. If it could be made to work at all, it was, like a fire, potentially unlimited. To build it larger, you only piled on more heavy hydrogen. As Los Alamos paid less attention to Teller's super, his projection of its destructive potential grew more grandiose. Robert Oppenheimer also committed himself at that time to exploring the thermonuclear, after the war was won, in a letter to Richard Tolman on September 20, 1944. "I should like," he emphasized, "to put in writing at an early date the recommendation that the subject of initiating violent thermonuclear reactions be pursued with vigor and diligence, and promptly. A way station on the road to a full-scale thermonuclear might be a boosted fission bomb with a small charge of heavy hydrogen confined possibly within the core of an implosive device. In this connection, I should like to point out that fission gadgets of reasonable efficiency and suitable design can almost certainly induct significant thermonuclear reactions in deuterium, even under conditions where these reactions are not self-sustaining. It is not at all clear whether we shall actually make this development during the present project, but it is of great importance that such gadgets form an experimentally possible transition from a simple gadget to the super, and thus open the possibility of a not purely theoretical approach to the latter. In fact, not deuterium but tritium proved to be the necessary ingredient of a boosted fission bomb, and such weapons were not developed until long after the end of the war. Alluding then to the larger consequences that Bohr had revealed, Oppenheimer emphasized once more the urgency he attached to the pursuit of an H-bomb. In general, not only for the scientific, but also for the political evaluation of the possibilities of our project, the critical, prompt, and effective exploration of the extent to which energy can be released by thermonuclear reactions is clearly of profound importance. Working against the clock to build weapons that might end a long and bloody war strained life at Los Alamos, but also heightened it. "I always pitied our army doctors for their thankless job," comments Laura Fermi. "They had prepared for the emergencies of the battlefields, and they were faced instead with a high-strung bunch of men, women, and children. High-strung because altitude affected us, because our men worked long hours under unrelenting pressure. High-strung because we were too many of a kind, too close to one another, too unavoidable even during relaxation hours. And we were all, as Groves had warned his officers, not entirely tongue-in-cheek, crackpots. High-strung because we felt powerless under strange circumstances, irked by minor annoyances that we blamed on the army and that drove us to unreasonable and pointless rebellion." They made the best of it. Michi Teller waged pointed rebellion, saving the backyard trees to preserve a playground for her son. "I told the soldier in his big plow to leave me, please, the trees here," one of her friends remembers her recounting, "so Paul could have shade. But he said, I got orders to level off everything so we can plant it." Which made no sense, as it was planted by wild nature and suits me better than dust. The soldier left, but was back the next day and insisted he had more orders to finish this neck of the woods. So I called all the ladies to the danger, and we put chairs under the trees and sat on them. So what could he do? He shook his head and went away and has not come again. Contrariwise, to clear a ski area on the hill to the west of the mesa, George Kistakowski wrapped the trees with half necklaces of plastic explosive, and thus noisily but efficiently cut them down. Then we scrounged equipment to build a rope tow, and it became a nice little ski slope, he recalls. The Fermis moved to Los Alamos in September 1944 and requested one of the less coveted fourplex apartments rather than the ranch school faculty cottage that had been prepared for them, to make a point about social snobbery. The Peerlses, Rudolph and energetic Jenia, Otto Frisch's dish-drying coach in Birmingham, lived below. The mix of birthplaces and citizenships was typical of the Hill. Peerles, a German Jew, his wife a Russian, both with British citizenship. Laura Fermi, still nostalgic for Rome, but she and her husband knew American citizens as of July. "Oppie has whistled," Fermi would announce with a yawn when the morning siren sounded. "It's time to get up." The Italian laureate directed a new operation, F for Fermi Division, a catch-all designed to take advantage of his versatility as both theoretician and experimentalist. One of the groups he caught was Teller's. "That young man has imagination," the 43-year-old Italian emigre told his wife drolly of the 36-year-old Hungarian. "Should he take full advantage of his inventiveness, he will go a long way." Teller stayed up late at night working out ideas and playing the piano and hardly ever appeared in the tech area before late morning. Parties, remembers Fuse development group leader Robert Brody's articulate wife Bernice, both big and brassy and small and cheerful, were an integral part of Mesa life. It was a poor Saturday night that some large affair was not scheduled, and there were usually several of them. On Saturday nights, we raised whoopee. On Sundays, we took trips. The rest of the week, we worked. Single men and women sponsored dorm parties fueled with tanks of punch made potent with mixed liquors and pure tech area grain alcohol and invited wall-to-wall crowds. The singles removed all the furniture from their dormitory common rooms to make areas for dancing, and by unwritten rule, kept their upstairs doors open through the night. Square dancing evolved as a natural Saturday evening activity in that southwestern setting. Everybody was wearing western clothes, jeans, boots, parkas, Stanislaw Ulam's French wife Francois remembers noticing with surprise when she and her husband arrived on the hill. There was a feeling of a mountain resort in addition to army camp. The dances were first held in Deke Parsons' living room, then the theater, then Fuller Lodge, finally expanding to crowd the large mess hall. Eventually, even the Fermis attended with their daughter Nella to learn the vigorous reels. Long after mother and daughter had been persuaded from the sidelines, Fermi sat unbudging, mentally working out the steps. When he was ready, he asked Bernice Brody, one of the leaders, to be his partner. He offered to be head couple, which I thought most unwise for his first venture, but I couldn't do anything about it, and the music began. He led me out on the exact beat, knew exactly each move to make and when. He never made a mistake, then or thereafter, but I wouldn't say he enjoyed himself. He danced with his brains instead of his feet. Theater sometimes supplied a Saturday alternative. At a performance of Arsenic and Old Lace, Robert Oppenheimer surprised and delighted the audience by appearing powdered, sepulchrally white with flour as the first of the crowd of corpses emerging from the cellar in the last act. Donald Flanders, tall and bearded, known as Maul, computation group leader in the theoretical division, wrote a comic ballet, Sacra du Mesa, set to George Gershwin music. Despite his beard and his lack of ballet training, Flanders danced the part of General Groves. Samuel Allison's son Keith appeared as Oppenheimer, dancing on a large table, wearing suitably casual clothes and a pork pie hat. The main stage prop, Bernice Brody notes, was a mechanical brain with flashing lights and noisy bangs and sputters, which did consistently wrong calculations. For example, 2 + 2 = 5. In the grand but hectic finale, the wrong calculations were revealed as the real sacred mystery of the Mesa. Kistiakowski preferred less formally intellectual entertainment. I played a lot of poker with important people like Johnny von Neumann, Stan Ulam, etc. When I came to Los Alamos, I discovered that these people didn't know how to play poker and offered to teach them. At the end of the evening, they got annoyed occasionally when we added up the chips. I used to point out that if they had tried to learn violin playing, it would cost them even more per hour. Unfortunately, before the end of the war, these great theoretical minds caught on to poker, and the evening's accounts became less attractive from my point of view. And Robert Wilson, cyclotron program group leader, who served on the advisory town council, discovered even more elemental activities on the Hill despite security screening before employment and roving military police. Of the many problems that were presented to us during my term of office, the most memorable was when the MPs who guarded the site chose to place one of our women's dorms off limits. They recommended that we close the dorm and dismiss the occupants. A tearful group of young ladies appeared before us to argue to the contrary. Supporting them, a determined group of bachelors argued even more persuasively against closing the dorm. It seems that the girls had been doing a flourishing business of requiting the basic needs of our young men, and at a price. All understandable to the army, until disease reared its ugly head. Hence their interference. By the time we got that matter straightened out, and we did decide to continue it, I was a considerably more learned physicist than I had intended to be a few years earlier, when going into physics was not all that different from taking the cloth. Married or single, the occupants of Post Office Box 1663 were young and healthy. They produced so many babies that Groves ordered either the reservation commander or the laboratory director, both versions of the story survive, to staunch the flood. Oppenheimer, if Oppenheimer it was, refused the duty. With justification, his wife Kitty bore him a second child, a daughter, Catherine, called Tony, on December 7, 1944. So many people wanted to see the boss's baby that the hospital identified the crib with a sign and lines formed to file past the nursery window. Crowded together, behind a fence, Hill families worried about epidemic disease. A pet dog that had bitten several children turned up rabid, and pet owners debated angrily with parents about which category of dependent should be kept on a leash. More frightening was the sudden death of a young chemist, a group leader's wife, from an unidentified form of paralysis. Fearing an outbreak of poliomyelitis, doctors closed the schools, put Santa Fe off limits, and ordered all children indoors. No new cases appeared. The danger abated with the continuation of cold weather, and work and play resumed. I don't think I shall ever again live in a community where so many brains were, comments Edwin McMillan's wife Elsie, Ernest Lawrence's sister-in-law. Nor shall I ever live in a community so confined that visitors expected us to fight with each other. We didn't have telephones, we didn't have the bright lights, but I don't think I shall ever live in a community that had such deep roots of cooperation and friendship. Some reserved Sundays for church and hobbies, others devoted the day to outings. The Oppenheimers maintained magnificent riding horses and rode regularly on Sunday morning, but only once in 3 years found time for an overnight excursion. Kistiakowski bought one of the Oppenheimers' quarter horses and refreshed himself trailing in the mountains after his late Saturday poker nights. The army stabled the private animals along with the remuda it kept for the mounted MPs who patrolled the mesa fences. Emilio Segre found excellent fly fishing. "The streams are full of big trouts," he announced happily to newcomers. "All you have to do is throw in a line and they bite you, even if you are shouting." Fermi took up angling, says Segre, but he went about it in a peculiar way. He had tackle different from what anyone else used for trout fishing, and he developed theories about the way fish should behave. When these were not substantiated by experiment, he showed an obstinacy that would have been ruinous in science. Fermi insisted on fishing for trout with worms, arguing that the condemned creatures should be offered an authentic final meal, not the dry flies of tradition. Segre made a point of reviewing the subtleties of trout fishing with his old friend. "Oh, I see, Emilio," Fermi eventually countered. "It is a battle of wits." Mountain climbing had long been a Hans Bethe hobby. He and Fermi, among others, sometimes scaled Lake Peak across the Rio Grande in the Sangre de Cristos. One of Bethe's admiring group leaders remembers to sit in the sunshine at 12,500 feet discussing physics problems. This is how many discoveries were made. Leona Marshall, who moved with Fermi to Los Alamos, recalls Les Olympian hours, with nothing to do but admire the view and gasp for breath. Equally strenuous excursions went out to area landmarks. Henia Pearls and Bernice Brody determined to find the stone lions, prehistoric life-size twin effigies of crouching mountain lions carved in tuff, reported beside a ruined pueblo on a distant mesa. They gathered up a carload of Navy ensigns and another of young bachelors from the British mission and drove within 10 miles of their goal, then set out walking. Henny appears leading the way in tennis shoes without socks. Best for stones, best for bunions. Lunch at 2 p.m. by a cool canyon stream encouraged the weary ensigns to drop anchor, but Mrs. Pearls had cowed the young British mission men from similar protest. "Okay, we proceed to Stone Lions without U.S. Navy. All aboard." More hiking, crossing desert country from mesa to mesa, the Rio Grande below. The American woman was impressed with the stone lions. Not so the Russian. House cats only, my dear. Not well made, and maybe not even old. On the way back, Bernice Brody recalls, the young men looked out over the wide expanse of the desert region and the ribbon of water shining in the setting sun. One of them, dark and slim, wearing tortoiseshell-rimmed glasses, spoke in his soft voice with a slight German accent. I have not seen New York nor Chicago, but I have seen the stone lions. He smiled pleasantly as we walked on. His name was Klaus Fuchs. Penny in the Slot Fuchs, Annie Imperials nicknamed him, because the quiet, hard-working emigre theoretician only spoke when spoken to. On a hike through Frijoles Canyon with the Fermis, Niels Bohr stopped to admire a skunk, an animal unknown to Europeans, but it chose not to instruct the vigorous Dane in the pungency of its defenses. Bears sometimes appeared on the trails, prompting warnings in the Daily Bulletin. Remember that these are not tame bears like those in Yellowstone Park. A family cat turned up with a suppurating jaw. The Hill's Army veterinarian recognized the bone necrosis as a sign of radiation poisoning from tech area contamination and kept the animal alive to observe its unusual symptomatology, about which not much was yet known. Its tongue swelled and its hair fell out in patches. Its heartsick owner eventually asked that the animal be destroyed. A low-power radio station began broadcasting to Hill residents on Christmas Eve, 1943, drawing on several fine collections of classical records, including Oppenheimer's. The few New Mexicans beyond the hill who could receive the station's signals were puzzled that announcers never introduced live performers by their last names. The Otto, who occasionally played classical piano selections, was Otto Frisch. A golf course opened in June 1944. Men and women fielded baseball, softball, and basketball teams. The Army divided up the old ranch school truck garden east of Fuller Lodge into victory gardening plots, but had no water to spare for irrigation. Life was rougher for construction workers, machinists, soldiers, and WACs. Minimal barracks, jerry-built dormitories, muddy trailer courts. Hillbilly construction families invited once in the interest of authenticity to the square dancing at the mess hall arrived drunk and nearly caused a riot. Thereafter, a man in uniform guarded the door. Hans Bethe recalls that one wild machinist late in the war, when the laboratory took what help it could find, slit a fellow worker's throat from cover to cover. The Indians from San Ildefonso and the other pueblos and ranches in the area lived better for their work on the hill as cleaning women and maintenance men. The hand-coiled black pottery of Maria Martinez soon graced many Los Alamos apartments. In winter, a pall of coal smoke hung over the mesa. The men the Army assigned to service the apartment furnaces stoked them so hot that apartment walls sometimes sizzled. Los Alamos sat high and dry, surrounded by pine forests, and fire worried everyone. The main machine shop in the tech area caught fire one night, early in 1945. Eleanor Jette remembers watching her husband Eric, metal reduction group leader in the chemistry and metallurgy division, standing with Oppenheimer and the Hill commanding officer on the fire escape of the administration building, grimly overseeing the firefighters. Jesus, she heard someone say. Let's be thankful it isn't D building. That place is as hot as $7 million. Every time it gets too hot for them to work, they slap on another coat of paint. Her husband worked in D building. She did not know he worked with plutonium, but understood that hot meant radioactive. Damn, he told her when she asked. You mustn't be upset. We're so careful, it's fantastic. A fire in the plutonium handling areas would be a major disaster. After the machine shop fire, Groves ordered a fireproof plutonium works built with steel walls and a steel roof and filtering systems for both incoming and outgoing air. Robert Oppenheimer oversaw all this activity with self-evident competence and an outward composure that almost everyone came to depend upon. Oppenheimer was probably the best lab director I have ever seen, Teller repeats, because of the great mobility of his mind because of his successful effort to know about practically everything important invented in the laboratory, and also because of his unusual psychological insight into other people, which, in the company of physicists, was very much the exception. He knew and understood everything that went on in the laboratory, Betha concurs. Whether it was chemistry, or theoretical physics, or machine shop, he could keep it all in his head and coordinate it. It was clear also at Los Alamos that he was intellectually superior to us. The theoretical division leader elaborates. He understood immediately when he heard anything, and fitted it into the general scheme of things and drew the right conclusions. There was just nobody else in that laboratory who came even close to him in his knowledge. There was human warmth as well. Everybody certainly had the impression that Oppenheimer cared what each particular person was doing. In talking to someone, he made it clear that that person's work was important for the success of the whole project. I don't remember any occasion at Los Alamos in which he was nasty to any person, whereas before and after the war, he was often that way. At Los Alamos, he didn't make anybody feel inferior, not anybody. Yet Oppenheimer felt inferior himself, had always felt for the actions of his life, as he confessed many years afterward, a very great sense of revulsion and of wrong. At Los Alamos, for the first time, he seems to have found alleviation of that loathing. He may have discovered there a process of self-analysis, anchored in complementarity, that served him more comprehensively later in his life. In an attempt to break out and be a reasonable man, I had to realize that my own worries about what I did were valid and were important, but that they were not the whole story, that there must be a complementary way of looking at them, because other people did not see them as I did. And I needed what they saw, and needed them. Certainly he found the more traditional alleviation of losing himself in work. Whatever his burden of morale and work in those years, Oppenheimer also carried his full share of private pain. He was kept under constant surveillance, his movements monitored, and his rooms and telephones bugged. Strangers observed his most intimate hours. His home life cannot have been happy. Kitty Oppenheimer responded to the stress of living at isolated Los Alamos by drinking heavily. Eventually, Martha Parsons, the admiral's daughter, took over the duties of social leadership on the Hill. Army security officers hounded the director of the Central Laboratory of the nation's most important secret war project mercilessly. At least one of them, Pierre De Silva, was convinced Oppenheimer was a Soviet spy. They interrogated him frequently, fishing for the names of people he knew or believed to be members of the Communist Party, hoping to trip him up. He invented circumstances and volunteered the names of friends to protect his own indiscretions that would return in time to haunt him. During the first Los Alamos summer, he heard from Jean Tatlock, the unhappy woman he had loved before he met his wife. Loyally, even though she had been and still might be a communist, and he knew himself to be spied upon, he went to her. An FBI document coldly summarizes a security man's peep show version of that meeting. On June 14, 1943, Oppenheimer traveled via Key Railway from Berkeley to San Francisco on the evening of June 14, 1943, where he was met by Jean Tatlock, who kissed him. They dined at the Zocomilcho Cafe, 787 Broadway, San Francisco, then proceeded at 10:50 p.m. to 1405 Montgomery Street and entered a top-floor apartment. Subsequently, the lights were extinguished, and Oppenheimer was not observed until 8:30 a.m. next day, when he and Jean Tatlock left the building together. In January 1944, Jean Tatlock committed suicide. "I wanted to live and to give and I got paralyzed somehow," her suicide note said. It was a paralysis of the spirit Oppenheimer seemingly had to resist in himself. Planning began in March 1944 for a full-scale test of an implosion weapon. Sometime between March and October, Oppenheimer proposed a code name for that test. The first man-made nuclear explosion would be an historic event, and its designation therefore a name that history might remember. Oppenheimer coded the test and the test site Trinity. Groves wrote him in 1962 to find out why, speculating that he chose the name because it is common to rivers and peaks in the American West and would be inconspicuous. "I did suggest it," Oppenheimer responded, "but not on that ground. Why I chose the name is not clear, but I know what thoughts were in my mind. There is a poem of John Donne, written just before his death, which I know and love. From it, a quotation. As west and east, in all flat maps, and I am one, are one, so death doth touch the resurrection." The poem was Donne's hymn to God my God in my sickness, and among its subtleties, it construes a complementarity that parallels the complementarity of the bomb that Bohr had recently revealed to Oppenheimer. Bohr was deeply in this, Bethe testifies, and this was his real interest, and Bohr had long conversations with Oppenheimer, which brought Oppenheimer into this at a very early stage. Oppenheimer was very much indoctrinated by Bohr's ideas of international control. That dying leads to death, but might also lead to resurrection, as the bomb for Bohr and Oppenheimer was a weapon of death that might also end war and redeem mankind, is one way the poem expresses the paradox. "That still does not make a trinity," Oppenheimer's letter to Groves goes on, but in another, better-known devotional poem, Donne opens, "Batter my heart, three-personed God. Beyond this I have no clues whatsoever, nor must Groves have had. But the 14th of Donne's Holy Sonnets equally explores the theme of a destruction that might also redeem. Batter my heart, three-personed God, for you, as yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend, that I may rise and stand, o'erthrow me, and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like an usurped town, to another do, labor to admit you, but oh, to no end. Reason, your viceroy in me, me should defend, but is captived, and proves weak or untrue. Yet dearly I love you, and would be loved fain, but am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie, or break that knot again. Take me to you, imprison me, for I accept you enthrall me. Never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me." That is poetry perhaps martial enough, ardent enough, and sufficiently fraught with paradox to supply a code name for the first secret test of a millennial force newly visited upon the world. Oppenheimer did not doubt that he would be remembered to some degree, and reviled as the man who led the work of bringing to mankind, for the first time in its history, the means of its own destruction. He cherished the complimentary compensation of knowing that the hard riddle the bomb would pose had two answers, two outcomes, one of them transcendent. Such understanding justified the work at Los Alamos, if anything did, and the work in turn healed the split between self and overweening conscience that hurt him. He had long recognized the possibility of such a convalescence, and evoked it explicitly in the epistle on discipline he wrote his brother Frank in 1932 that concluded in Pauline measure, "Therefore I think that all things which evoke discipline, study, and our duties to men and to the commonwealth, war and personal hardship, and even the need for subsistence, ought to be greeted by us with profound gratitude, for only through them can we attain to the least detachment, and only so can we know peace." At Los Alamos, if only for a time, he located that detachment in duties to men and to the Commonwealth that Bohr was teaching him to believe might be worthy, not macabre. He was not the first man to find himself in war. To develop implosion, Los Alamos had to develop diagnostics, ways to see and to measure events that began and ended in considerably less time than the blink of an eye. The iron pipes Seth Neddermeyer imploded could be studied by aiming a high-speed flash camera down their bores, but how could the physicists of G Division observe the shaping of a detonation wave as it passed through solid blocks of high explosives, or the compression of the metal sphere which those explosives completely surrounded? They were competent research scientists who had been working within narrow technological constraints for a year and a half. Diagnostics demanded imagination, and they brought all their frustrated creativity to the task. X-raying was a reliable approach. The Ordnance Division had already used X-rays to study the behavior of small spherical arrangements of explosives. X-rays reveal differences in density. Dense bone casts a darker shadow than lighter flesh. And since the detonation wave of a developing implosion changed the density of the explosive material as it burned its way through, X-rays could make that wave visible. But adapting X-ray diagnostics to implosion studies on an increasing scale meant protecting fragile X-ray equipment from the repeated blasts of as much as 200 pounds of high explosives at a time. That challenge the physicists met by the unorthodox expedient of mounting their implosion tests between two closely spaced blockhouses, with the X-ray unit in one building and the radiography equipment in the other, accessible to the test event through protected ports. Ultimately, flash X-ray equipment, high-current X-ray tubes that pulsed as rapidly as every 10 millionth of a second, proved most useful for detonation wave studies. The behavior of a test unit's HE shell was easier to study with X-rays and high-speed photography than was the compression of its denser metal core. For following the metal core as it squeezed to less than half its previous volume, Los Alamos developed several different diagnostic methods and used them in complement. One method set the test unit within a magnetic field and measured changes in field configuration as the metal sphere compressed. Since HE is essentially transparent to magnetism, this method allowed the physicists eventually to study full-scale assemblies. It gave reliable measure of shock waves reflected from the core and of the troublesome detonation wave intersections that caused jets and spalling. Carefully spaced, prearranged wires contacted by the metal sphere as it imploded supplied information not only about the timing of the implosion, but also about material velocities at various depths within the core. That provided direct, quantitative data, which the theoretical division could use to check how well its hydrodynamic theory fit the facts. The electric method group began by measuring the high explosive acceleration of flat metal plates. Early in 1945, it adapted its techniques to partial spheres and eventually to spheres surrounded by HE lens systems with only one lens removed to access the necessary wires. Duplicated at another test site, the blockhouse arrangement that served to protect ordinary X-ray equipment also served to shield the most unusual diagnostic method the scientists devised, firing pulsed X-rays from a betatron through scale model implosion units into a cloud chamber and photographing the resulting ionization tracks with a stereoscopic camera. The betatron method needed an ingenious timing circuit to trigger in quick but precise sequence the explosive charge, the betatron X-ray pulse, the expansion of the diaphragm of the cloud chamber that made the ionization tracks visible as droplets in the fog, and the camera shutters that photographed them. The fifth successful method G Division developed varied the betatron method by incorporating an intense source of gamma radiation within the core itself. The source, radioactive lanthanum extracted from among fission products of the Oak Ridge air-cooled pile, gave the method its name, Rayleigh. Not a cloud chamber, but alignments of rugged ionization chambers served to register the changing patterns of radiation from the Rayleigh cores as they compressed. Since no one knew at first how extensively the radiolanthanum would contaminate the test site, Luis Alvarez, who coordinated the first experiment, borrowed two tanks from the Army's Dugway Proving Ground in Utah to use as temporary blockhouses. He recalls spectacular results. "I was sitting in the tank when the first explosion went off. George Kistiakowski was in one tank and I was in the other. We were looking through the periscopes and all that happened was that it blew a lot of dust in our eyes. And then, we hadn't thought about this possibility at all, the whole forest around us caught on fire. These pieces of white hot metal went flying off into the wild blue yonder, setting trees on fire. We were almost surrounded." Implosion lens development had begun the previous winter, says Betta, when John von Neumann very quickly designed an arrangement which was obviously correct from the theoretical point of view. I had tried and failed. Now, in the fall and winter of 1944-45, Kistiakowski had to make the theoretical arrangement work. "An optical lens takes advantage of the fact that light travels at different velocities in different media. Light traveling through air slows when it encounters glass. If the glass curves convexly, as a magnifying glass is curved, the light that encounters the thicker center must follow a longer path than the light that encounters the thinner edges. The effect of these differing path lengths is to direct the light toward a focal point." The implosion lens system von Neumann designed was made up of truncated pyramidal blocks about the size of car batteries. The assembled lenses formed a sphere with their smaller ends pointing inward. Each lens consisted of two different explosive materials fitted together, a thick, fast-burning outer layer and a shaped, slow-burning, solid inclusion that extended to the surface of the face of the block that pointed toward the bomb core. The fast-burning outer layer functioned for the detonation wave, as air around an optical lens functions for light. The slower-burning, shaped inclusion functioned as a magnifying glass, directing and reshaping the wave. A detonator would ignite the fast-burning explosive. That material would develop a spherical detonation wave. When the apex of the wave advanced into the apex of the inclusion, however, it would begin burning more slowly. The delay would give the rest of the wave time to catch up. As the detonation wave encountered and burned through the inclusion, it thus reshaped itself from convex to concave, from a spherical wave expanding from a point to a spherical wave converging on a point, emerging fitted to the convex curve of the spherical tamper. Before the reshaped wave reached the tamper, it passed through a second layer of solid blocks of fast-burning explosive to add to its force. The heavy natural uranium tamper then served to smooth out any minor irregularities as the spherical shockwave compressed it passing through to the plutonium core. Kistiakowski would apologize after the war for a research program too frequently reduced to guesswork and empirical shortcuts because the field had been grossly neglected. "Prior to this war, the subject of explosives attracted very little scientific interest," he wrote in an introduction to a technical history of X Division's work. "These materials being looked upon as blind destructive agents rather than precision instruments. The level of fundamental knowledge concerning detonation waves and strong shock waves induced by them in the adjacent non-explosive media was distressingly low." To support its experiments, X Division expanded an explosives casting site a few miles south of Anchor Ranch, constructing rough-hewn, earth-sheltered timber buildings because hauling in concrete would have delayed the work. Not until mid-December 1944 did a lens test look promising. The 18 5-kilogram bombs Groves told George Marshall he hoped to have on hand by the second half of 1945, he also thought might explode so inefficiently that each would be equivalent to no more than 500 tons of TNT, down from the 1,000 tons Conant had heard estimated in October. Kistiakowski had to fight once more with Parsons before he won the field. So much pessimism was developing about our ability to build satisfactory lenses, he recalls, that Captain Parsons began urging, and he was not alone in this, that we give up lenses completely and try somehow to patch up the non-lens type of implosion. Kistiakowsky thought that alternative hopeless. Early in 1945, Groves came out to monitor the debate. In the end, Oppenheimer took Kistiakowsky's side and decided for lenses. Parsons' Ordnance Division then restricted its work to the uranium gun, Little Boy, and to engineering the weapons for the battlefield. X and G divisions worried about implosion. Finishing the high-explosive castings by machining them was the most dramatic innovation Kistiakowsky introduced. He wanted to shape the HE components entirely by machining from solid precast blocks, but lacked sufficient time to develop and build the elaborate remote-controlled machinery the innovative technology would have required. He settled instead for precision casting with machine finishing, and used his limited supply of machinists primarily to turn out the necessary molds. Molds gave him the greatest agony, he remembers. The HE components of the bomb totaled something in the nature of 100 or so pieces, which had to fit together to within a precision of a few thousandths of an inch on a total size of 5 feet and make a sphere. So we had to have very precise molds. Eventually, mold procurement paced Fat Man's testing and delivery. But even with the necessary molds on hand, casting HE was far from simple, another technology that had to be learned by trial and error. In February 1945, Kistiakowsky chose an explosive called Composition B to serve as the fast-burning component of Fat Man's lenses and a mixture he had commissioned from a Navy research laboratory, Baritol, for the slow-burning component. Composition B was poured as a hot slurry of wax, molten TNT, and a non-melting crystalline powder, RDX, that was 40% more powerful than TNT alone. Baritol slurried barium nitrate and aluminum powder with TNT, stereoxacetic acid, and nitrocellulose. We learned gradually that these large castings, 50 pounds and more each, had to be cooled in just certain ways. Otherwise, you get air bubbles in the middle or separations of solids and liquids, all of which screwed up the implosion completely. So it was a slow process. The explosive was poured in, and then people sat over that damn thing watching it as if an egg were being hatched, changing the temperature of the water running through the various cooling tubes built into the mold. The wilderness reverberated that winter to the sounds of explosions, gradually increasing in intensity as the chemists and physicists applied small lessons at larger scale. We were consuming daily, says Kistiakowsky, something like a ton of high-performance explosives made into dozens of experimental charges. The total number of castings, counting only those of quality sufficient to use, would come to more than 20,000. X Division managed more than 50,000 major machining operations on those castings in 1944 and 1945, without one explosive accident. Vindication of Kistiakowsky's precision approach. A Rayleigh test on February 7, 1945, showed definite improvement in implosion symmetry. On March 5th, after a strained round of conferences, Oppenheimer froze lens design. However scarce plutonium might be, no one doubted that Fat Man would have to be tested at full scale before a military weapon could be trusted to work. A problem small in scale